Welcome, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Supreme Decisions Legal Minute Podcast. And this is your host, Supreme Decisions. Now, today I'm going to kind of deviate from my normal ranting and conversational piece. And I'm going to actually have an actual conversation. Today's guest is none other than Henry Garris Esquire. He is the founder of the Garris Law Firm. Now, he's going to give you a quick breakdown as only, you know, someone that understands this can of, one, understanding your Miranda rights. He's going to give you a little bit of background on himself. He's also going to go into things like, are you being charged with a crime? Give you the conversational piece of, am I free to go? And last, we're going to finish with, do you have a warrant and understanding how not to waive your constitutional rights? Now, with all of that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Garris, and he can explain to you who he is and why you should listen to him. Mr. Garris, how are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on with you. And I was born and raised in the San Fernando Valley. And I went to UC Riverside for undergraduate, and I studied history with a little emphasis on law and society. Then I went to Pepperdine for law school, and while I was at law school, I got a master's in dispute resolution as well. And that's kind of alternative dispute resolution, alternative to litigation, things like mediation, arbitration. And I focused on that because initially I thought I was going to practice family law, and a specific niche of family law called collaborative divorce. But just like they said in law school, things don't always turn out the way that you initially expect. And I found myself practicing criminal defense. I ended up at an office in Kern County, ended up working with one of my friends from junior high, who's also an attorney, and practiced there for about a year and a half, and then started my own firm. And we started right at the peak of the pandemic, March 2020. So that was fun. And we've been taking on cases, and we focus on client-centered caring counsel. And that's how we differentiate ourselves. It's really about bringing empathy back to the legal field and the criminal defense world. And that's what we stand for.
Okay, I got a quick question, because that's a phenomenal thing to do, because I often talk about the disenfranchised and the actual war on the poor. What got you to actually kind of pivot, like you said, from family law to the criminal law?
It's funny you ask. You know, in family law, especially where I was working at a firm in Calabasas. And the partners at the firm dealt with celebrities, like B-list celebrities, and affluent people. So oftentimes, the divorces were messy. They involved, you know, the financials were messy. And the parties themselves would fight over the most arbitrary things. Parking spaces, you know, clothes. And after a while, I just thought to myself, you know, this doesn't give me a sense of fulfillment. And so I was talking with my friend from junior high one day after work, and he was explaining to me about what he did. He was a public defender at Kern County, and he still is a public defender now in LA. And he was just talking to me about the mission, about giving a voice to the voiceless, to the forgotten, you know, fighting for the people that can't fight for themselves, speaking for the people that have no one to speak for them. And it really touched me. And I actually applied to every public defender's office in the state and volunteered for a few months at a public defender's office in Santa Barbara. That's how committed I was to making the change. And then I ended up in Kern County with my buddy and worked there for about a year and a half.
Okay. So you started your actual law firm March of 2020, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you've been practicing just for you for a year almost, But prior to that, was that part of the public defender's office, or what exactly was that? Was that the internship, I guess you would call that, since it was a voluntary type thing?
Well, no, we're nearing 2 years with my firm. And with the public defender's office in Kern County, I was employed as an attorney, and I was also employed as an attorney in Santa Barbara, but I was just volunteering.
Okay. And a quick, I guess, question would be, what has been the most or the major case that you have tried thus far as litigation?
Well, there was a domestic violence case where my client was acquitted. That was a very interesting case factually. It was a case where we had to overcome many obstacles in regards to what was in evidence.
Okay.
And, you know, oftentimes in domestic violence, especially with photographs and with child testimony, it's challenging. So as a defense attorney, that was definitely an accomplishment that is up there at the top of the list.
Okay. Here's I guess, where we can actually start getting a better understanding of some of the things, because one of the things we said we were going to speak about was understanding your Miranda rights and how to engage with police before and after being accused of a crime. Because I did a series originally called Police Encounters, because most people don't understand the number of people, while it actually blew my mind when I saw it, was like 1 in 4 are pretty much going to have some type of police interaction. And it's not necessarily in a year, but this is going over the span of a lifetime. So mostly 40, 45 years, you're probably not going to have any police encounters. But those that do, what are some of the things that they can do to kind of protect themselves within their Miranda rights?
Well, the first thing I tell all my clients is don't talk to law enforcement. You know, don't talk to the police. Exercise your right to an attorney. That's why we're here. Exercise your right to an attorney. Don't talk to law enforcement. You know, oftentimes people are completely innocent and they feel like they have nothing to hide, and they talk to law enforcement on that premise. And things get misconstrued, and sometimes they regret talking to law enforcement, you know? So, you know, sometimes there's a situation that warrants law enforcement. And don't get me wrong, law enforcement is a necessary part of society. It is what keeps us safe, and it is a necessary ingredient in society. But in order to protect your rights in a scenario where you are being investigated for a potential crime, I would advise clients not to speak to police before exercising their right to an attorney. And, you know, if police arrive onto a scene, which can be a public area or a road or a highway or a residence, they're arriving either because they've been given information from 911 dispatch or because they've observed something. You know, they've observed a commission of a crime or reasonable suspicion that a crime is, or activity that rises to reasonable suspicion that a crime may be committed. And on that basis, they could stop a person. You know, if they have reasonable suspicion, they can stop a person. Say that you're in a motor vehicle, you know, and a cop observes that your license plate is expired. You know, your registration's expired on your license plate. Then they can stop you. That's reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed, you know. And sometimes after a stop, there's a scenario that warrants additional investigation. And during that time when law enforcement is investigating you, they can detain you in order to conduct their investigation. Now, that is a point where oftentimes people don't understand their rights fully, you know. Oftentimes people think that as soon as you're if you've been detained, that a cop has to Mirandize you. You know, but that's not necessarily the case. During the time when they're investigating a potential crime and they're following up on their investigations, they don't have to necessarily Mirandize you. They Mirandize you when you're in a situation where there's custodial interrogation. And that's a term of art. Custodial means a reasonable person doesn't feel that they're free to leave. An interrogation means that they're being asked questions that elicit an incriminating response, right? So it's reasonable for a person that's in police custody after having been detained to believe that they're not free to go, which meets the custodial part of custodial interrogation. But they're not being asked questions that elicit an incriminating response. You know, it depends on what the investigation is. If a police officer is searching a vehicle, you know, that subject is not being asked questions that can elicit an incriminating response. If while searching the vehicle, law enforcement finds something that subjects that person to being arrested, rises to the level of probable cause for an arrest, then that person, you know, can be arrested. And later on, if they're interrogated and they start being asked questions relating to the conduct that was the basis of their arrest, that would meet the second requirement, questions that could elicit an incriminating response. At that point, before going further, law enforcement or the police would have to Mirandize you, right? At which point you can, at any point, you as a citizen can exercise your right to remain silent, and you can invoke your right to an attorney, at which point the questioning has to stop. You know, so it's really important to understand that, you know, there's nuances and technicalities to the law and things that you may not think can be an issue later on can become an issue.
Absolutely, because one of the things I often speak about is the right to remain silent, but most people have the inability to. And I often speak about the innocent. Those make the worst clients because they feel, just as you said, they haven't done anything wrong, so they feel free to say and do things and even participate in the investigation, which is not required at any point during law.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, later on they find that their own words are being twisted in a way that they didn't expect or are being supplemented to a context that they had no information in regards to, you know, and in the aggregate, something that started off as, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, let me speak my piece, turns into now I'm involved in this case.
Absolutely. And I often speak against holding court in the street because at the end of the day, a police officer has discretion to do certain things. They also have reasons, whether it's known or unknown, for them to do other things. The place for all of this to take place is in a courtroom, because you have safety nets such as Frank's hearings, you have Wade hearings, you have these things, MAP hearings, you have all these options, like you stated, that an attorney could guide you through, or someone that is well-versed in those types of defenses. But doing that on the side of the road is not the place that should or is able to even be taking place. Now, one of the things I want you to go a little deeper into is because you spoke about the actual searching or the consent to search. Talk about the consent to search first and then go into plain view. And then we'll go on to the second part of the arrest conversation.
Absolutely. So the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution precludes government agents from unlawfully searching a person, a citizen, or seizing their property. And that extends to the states through the 14th Amendment. And in California, Penal Code 1523 through 1542 goes over the warrantless exceptions. So the general rule is that a government agent needs a warrant in order to search your house or your person or seize your property. But there are certain scenarios that are outside of that general warrant requirement, and those are the warrantless exceptions. And one of the the most popular ones is voluntary consent, right? If a law enforcement agent comes to your home and knocks on your door, and you are the resident that lives at that house, and you are of age, over 18, and you consent to the home being searched, then you have waived your right to be free from search. Another example is plain view. Say, for example, you're on the road and you're stopped because of a simple traffic violation. And in conducting their investigation, in writing the citation, a law enforcement agent observes something that they believe gives rise to a search, right? A car is a little bit of a different scenario than a home, because it's moving, right? So for an automobile, someone can give authority to search through consent as well. Or if the police believe that someone in the car is dangerous, they could search the car. Or if the car has been impounded, they can conduct an inventory search. But prior to that, if they observe something in plain view, say, for example, drugs, weapons, in plain view, that is a basis to then search the car as well. And that's a warrantless exception. Also, if you're stopped in a vehicle and you're arrested, then they could search your person and your vehicle subject to arrest. That's another warrantless exception. So that kind of ties back to the arrest, like you were saying.
Okay, and that would actually then fall back to the original Miranda understandings, because in order for them to even get to a point of arrest or even a point of Mirandizing you, there has to be some sort of probable cause of a crime that has taken place that pretty much you could have caused.
Right. So let's think about it this way, right?
Okay.
First, there's an incident that happens out someplace, either on the street or in public. Then law enforcement shows up. They either stop you or they start to investigate. And in the process of their investigation, they may search you, right? And in the process of searching you, if they have a warrant, or if there's a warrantless exception, like we just went over, voluntary consent, and they observe something that is in plain view in the course of their investigation, and they believe that rises to the level of probable cause that a crime has been committed and that you're the person that committed that crime, then they can arrest you. And after they arrest you, in order to further investigate and you know, find out what happened and who's responsible, they may interrogate you. And if you are arrested, you're now in the custody of law enforcement. And in the course of the interrogation, you're being asked questions that elicit an incriminating response. That's the scenario where you have to be Mirandized. And if you're not Mirandized and you volunteer information later on in the process, in the litigation process, that evidence can be stricken as fruit of the poisonous tree through, you know, various avenues, a 1538 motion, or there's various avenues, you know, depending on the stage of the litigation.
And that falls under basically some of the challenges I had spoke about in the defense.
Absolutely.
All right. And now let's go into the part that we've gone through the search. We've gone through that. You've actually being arrested and you are being charged with the crime. How would you navigate through the criminal justice system before or after being charged with a crime?
That's a great question. So, you know, there's two scenarios. Either you are arrested or you are cited and released. And that depends on the severity of the crime, right? If you're arrested, you're in the custody of a law enforcement agent. If you're cited and released, you have been given notice to appear in court. Then law enforcement forwards their reports from their investigation to the DA in the jurisdiction. You know, the DA has the discretion to file charges or not. And they can choose what charges to file, who to file against, whether to file priors, enhancements, special allegations, which all has a role in the exposure that a potential client or defendant can be faced, you know.
Okay.
I want to
jump in real quick, because like, I guess most of us will understand cited and released as like a traffic ticket. Do you have a couple other examples that would fall under the cited and released type situation?
Yeah. You know, most misdemeanors, which are crimes that are punishable by less than a year in the county jail, are crimes where oftentimes people are cited and released. And that's because the local jails are crowded. And there's not enough room to house everyone. So for lower level crimes, misdemeanors, you know, nonviolent misdemeanors, and general felonies, you can be cited and released. And it really depends on the officer and the facts of the crime. It's on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, the officer has the discretion.
Okay, so it's not any specific, okay, this is it, that's it. But most of the time, we'll be discussing the cite and release type deals with being cited with a citation or some type of traffic ticket.
It's not a citation in terms of you have to pay something. It's more that you are given notice that you are that you were arrested for these charges, and that you have notice to appear for an arraignment. And then the DA has, you know, a certain amount of time to file charges. And so they're giving you notice to saying, hey, these charges may be filed against you, and you have to appear on this day in court to answer to these charges.
Okay. I think that helps out a little bit. All right. Now, we were talking about, because I often speak about the cherry picking is the word I use when I talk about the discretion of the district attorney's office and filing and even setting up, as you said, the arraignment. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, I like to say that the right to a speedy arraignment is a right without a remedy, meaning that in California, you have a right to an arraignment within 2 days of the arrest, but the case is not going to be dismissed if the arraignment does not take place within 2 days. And the courts try to accommodate as much as possible, but, you know, the arraignment gives the client notice of the charges that they're facing, and the judge sets bail. And if the client is out of custody because they've been cited and released, then they make the decision, the court makes the decision as to whether or not they stay out of custody and remain out on bail or not. And also, depending on the nature of the case, if it's a domestic violence case, there's a criminal protective order that can be issued that would protect a person or prevent a person from having any communication with another person, telephonic, electronic, through third parties, etc. And that's the start of the criminal case, essentially. The first court date is the arraignment and puts the client or the defendant on notice of the charges that they're facing, and bail is set.
Okay. Now, what are some of the other things that you can kind of expect in just the being charged with the crime?
So after the arraignment, you know, there's something, it depends on whether it's you're facing misdemeanor charges or felony charges. For a misdemeanor, there's something, and it depends on your jurisdiction, there may be different names, but in the jurisdiction I work in, it's called a pretrial conference. It's essentially an opportunity for the parties to negotiate. The district attorney, the prosecutor, has an offer typically, and that offer is related to a defendant or client, and that client can make a potential counteroffer. Most of the cases are resolved that way. They reach a negotiated disposition, a plea is entered, the client is sentenced and serves a sentence. For a felony, a similar process is conducted, but after the arraignment, there's that discussion, that negotiation called a pre-preliminary hearing. And if a disposition is not reached at that pre-preliminary hearing, then it goes to a preliminary hearing, which is a hearing to determine whether or not a crime has been committed and if that person is the person that committed the crime. Essentially, it's an initial hearing for the court to determine if there's probable cause, if there's evidence that rises to the level of probable cause that a crime has been committed, which, of course, is different than the standard at trial, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest standard in the legal system. So if a judge finds that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed and that the defendant or the client has committed the crime, then they hold that client over. It's called held to answer. meaning that they're held to answer to the charges that they are charged with. But based off the evidence of the preliminary hearing, there may be additional charges that can potentially be added by the prosecutor, or there may be charges that may have been discharged by the judge, or reduced to a misdemeanor. So there's a second arraignment, and that arraignment is called the arraignment on information. And it makes sense because they're being arraigned off of the information that came out of the preliminary hearing, or the evidence that came out of the preliminary hearing, which may be the basis of additional charges or have charges stricken. Then there's another opportunity to negotiate, which is called a readiness hearing. And at that point, the parties have a better understanding of the evidence and what the arguments at trial would be, and the actual charges that would stick at trial. And they try to negotiate a disposition. And if the parties do not have a meeting of the minds, then they go to jury trial. And that has its own separate process and procedure as well.
Okay. That's actually intricate because it sounds like you got a bunch of hearings to just actually even set up to go to the actual show.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times people are wondering, like, oh, it's been a year. My case is still going. It's like, yep. And things take time. And COVID hasn't made it any easier, I'll tell you.
I can imagine. Now, oftentimes, because I hear this more often than not, because I even had a cop tell me that it was some internet stuff that I was saying. And it was the simple question of, am I free to go? Now, the question I have is, what is the understanding, basically the difference of being charged with the crime and being stopped as a suspect?
I think that that's a great question, and that's a question that people, citizens, need to ask law enforcement directly to themselves, directly to them. Ask if you are stopped and you have a question in your mind as to whether or not you can leave, ask the law enforcement agent, am I free to go? You know, sometimes that question doesn't need to be asked. You know, in a scenario where you are in a vehicle and you are stopped and you are detained and you are sitting on the curb, it's evident to that person that they are not free to go. They are in the custody of a police officer, right? But they haven't been Mirandized because they haven't been asked any questions that elicit an incriminating response. So that's a tricky area for people, right? Because they don't feel free to go. And, you know, their vehicle may be getting searched and they may be asked questions, but not questions that elicit an incriminating response. And so they may initially start answering questions, and then, you know, the fourth question could be a question that elicits an incriminating response and they answer as well. So I would suggest that, you know, if you are not in custody and you are having a conversation with a law enforcement agent and you have the question as to whether or not you're free to go, ask them if you're free to go or not. If you are in custody, if you are being detained subject to an investigation, I would ask, as soon as I'm being asked a question, I would exercise my right to an attorney. So so let's break that down again. If I was not in custody of the police, I would ask them if I'm free to go. If I am in custody, if I'm being detained and I'm physically in custody and in handcuffs, then as soon as I'm asked any questions, I would exercise my right to an attorney.
Okay. So if you have the right to leave, do what you do. If you do not have the right to leave, shut up.
Exactly. You said it in 10 words better than us. I ran it for 2 minutes.
That's all right, because I understand you're trying to make sure you're giving the correct information. That's the whole point of all of us being together. That's the whole point of the podcast. That's the point of the videos. It's to simplify and make it as easy as possible to understand, because I guarantee you nothing you did took you a week or a month or even a year to even learn or even understand. And then once you learned it, it probably took a little while in practice to actually perfect. And it's probably something you're still learning daily.
It's a lifelong practice. It's a practice of law.
Absolutely. All right. Now, I'm going to get into a couple other things because with me, myself, I've had a couple of issues, you know, where I've had police encounters. And I think only a couple times I've had to deal with this portion of it in reference to being arrested or even being searched. And one of the questions I often asked is, do you have a warrant? And basically, how do I kind of get into that and still not waive any rights that I have?
Well, you know, in a scenario where there's a law enforcement agent that is at your residence, right? And they're knocking on your door and they're requesting to search your residence. You asking, do you have a warrant, does not waive any of your rights, right? And remember that your Miranda rights, your right to remain silent, you know, your right to have an attorney, that exists still, right? You asking a question doesn't waive that right. And it's also, you're in your home. You're not in law enforcement custody, right? But say that it's a scenario where you're stopped in a vehicle.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, you're unsure as to whether or not law enforcement can search your car, right? Remember, there's those warrantless exceptions, right? It's unlikely that during a normal traffic stop, an officer is going to have a warrant. But say that, you know, you're an individual that they've been looking for. And so they do have a warrant to arrest you. And they may even have a search warrant to search your vehicle, right? And they stop you for that purpose. Remember that consent can waive. Consent is a warrantless exception. And, you know, if the car is later impounded, they can do an inventory search. And if police believe that someone in the car is dangerous, they could search the vehicle without a warrant, right? So, you know, yes, the general rule is you need a warrant to search, but there are many warrantless exceptions. And once again, that's in California, it's PC 1523 to 1542 that lists those exceptions. And so, you know, oftentimes, another one to watch out for is, you know, if you're in a vehicle, there's something called a Terry stop, where if an officer may have the suspicion that you have a weapon, they can search your outer clothing in a pat-down style, but they can only search for things that on touching is immediately apparent to be a weapon or drugs. And so that's supposed to be a limited search, but that's also another type of search that can be conducted without a warrant. And so those are the scenarios to really watch out for, you know, in a car, and you know, and for a Terry stop for the outer clothing.
I have one more quick question, and I'm gonna give you a scenario because you're speaking about California. I haven't experienced this in El Paso, but I have a friend that lives in Arizona now. He's from Chicago. And one of the things he talks about is he's often stopped by Border Patrol. Could you give me kind of scenarios about the warrant requirements for like international stops on border? Because I understand with the Border Patrol, in some places, they are allowed or allotted, I believe it's up to 100 miles inland, if I'm not mistaken.
And that's a great question because Border Patrol is one of the warrantless exceptions as well, but it has to be randomized. And you know, the distance may depend on the individual jurisdictions, but the general rule is that the search has to be random. So it has to be a system where they search, you know, one in every five cars, or they search one in every 10 cars, but it has to be a random system. And that would suffice for one of the warrantless exceptions.
Okay. So they would still have to, let me get my words together. they have to have either the ability to see something, or it falls under a random search with a collective group, pretty much?
Pretty much. Well, those are two different exceptions, right?
Oh, okay.
If they could see something, that's the plain view exception, right?
Okay.
If you see something in plain view, that's a warrantless exception. If you're passing through an international border or a state border, that's a warrantless exception as well. But the search has to be random if you're passing through an international border. Law enforcement can't target you because you're driving a certain car or because you look a certain way, right? The search has to be random. Or a Terry stop, like we discussed. There's various warrantless exceptions, and those exceptions are listed in the penal code that we discussed. And law enforcement can search you in any of those scenarios without a warrant.
Correct. And I've done a video where I actually spoke about 15 warrantless exceptions. And I think which the one you gave, I think that puts it at 19. So I left off four.
Yeah, there's a ton of them.
Now, we talked about the certain situations, even the outer clothing of the Terry stops. For you, what is the most frequent encounter that any of your clients run across? And then we're going to finish up with how can people get in contact with you that are in California?
Absolutely. So, you know, in regards to Terry stops, oftentimes in my experience, you know, having been at the public defender's office and working in Kern County, now in my private practice in LA, Terry stops often come up in scenarios where there's gang allegations alleged, you know, in scenarios where oftentimes in the reports, the officers would state that the individual was wearing a baggy jacket or baggy pants, and they were unable to determine whether or not they were concealing a weapon. And so they conducted a search of the outer clothing to determine such. You know, oftentimes, it's not shocking to see that factual scenario in cases where there's weapons found or where later on in the process there are gang allegations that are being alleged.
Okay.
But it really depends on a case-by-case basis. You know, you can... It really depends on case-by-case basis. But if I had to generalize and say where I see that instance the most in the jurisdictions that I work in, I would say, you know, either where... a weapon is in plain sight, or in cases where later on there's some sort of gang allegation that's alleged, gang enhancement.
All right, that's actually crazy. That's, especially to find out that's the majority of the people that you come and count or end up helping for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, like we discussed at the beginning, when the DA is deciding to file the complaint, they have the discretion to decide what charges to file and who to file against and what priors or enhancements. And something like a gang enhancement can add strikes. The gang enhancement in itself is a strike, and it adds years to the client's potential exposure. Now, in a scenario where a client is in custody and you know, there's a gang enhancement that's alleged to, you know, a gun charge or another serious charge. Now they could be looking at potentially two strikes and, you know, additional years added to their exposure, and being in custody, that weighs on their likelihood to enter a disposition. You know, it has an effect on whether or not they plea out. And, you know, it does play a large part in a lot of cases that I deal with out here.
Wow, that's crazy, because I speak about oftentimes the tactics that a prosecutor will use to actually help someone go into what I call the convenience or the fear mode, because those are the things that kind of get you into the plea bargaining or the deal agreements like you spoke of.
Yeah.
What's just one more question, because it popped in my head just a second ago. What are some of the things that could actually bring in someone's priors? Now, the reason why I'm asking this is because In 2008, I was charged with racketeering. When it came time for trial, myself and my older brother, we chose not to testify on our own behalf because both of us had felonies on our records. However, my younger brother, who testified, he had never been arrested before. But not that it did come into play, but what are some of the opportunities that you see in a trial situation where someone's priors may be brought up?
Well, in a trial situation, anytime someone is going to testify as a witness, their priors would be brought up by the opposing party to try to question the credibility of that witness, right? Because it puts them in a scenario, it's a win-win scenario, right? If you're asking someone, have you ever committed this felony, it automatically puts the jury on notice that you've, depending on your answer, if you say yes, it puts them on notice that you have committed a felony. If you say no, then it automatically gives grounds for the opposing party having proof that, you know, assuming that they do have proof, to then impeach that witness by introducing, you know, their rap sheet and showing the jury that prior, right? So then the response would be that the jury would lose, or that witness would lose credibility of the jury. And so that's the trial setting. But in the filing setting, you know, in regards to whether or not a DA is going to file a prior, that typically is referring to a prior strike. So felonies are categorized by general, serious, and felonies, or general, serious, and violent, excuse me. All violent felonies are strikes. All strikes are violent felonies. So a strike has consequences. It automatically doubles a potential a defendant's exposure. It automatically sends them to prison if they have a strike prior, and they have to serve their sentence at 80%, and they have to serve their sentence consecutive to whatever other sentence they're served. Right? So that's why in a scenario where, you know, you're being charged with a strike, say robbery, and then it's being alleged that you committed this robbery in furtherance of a gang, which is another strike. Now you're looking at two strikes, right? And then you have to add your exposure. Say you have a strike on your record already, and now you're subject to 25 to life, just like that. You know, so those are scenarios where you definitely have to contact an attorney, but there's intricacies in regards to the filing of priors and in regards to priors coming up by a witness testifying at trial.
Oh man, that's actually great because I want you to also just keep in mind or something, because I did a podcast maybe about 2 weeks ago where I talked about police character online and on trial. And one of the things I talked about was the simple fact, as a witness, you can actually go up and then go and, I guess, impeach, was the word you used, their character based on even their arrest records. It doesn't have to necessarily be something negative, but it's all about painting a picture as a defense attorney.
Yeah, you know, as a defense attorney in trial, one of the most effective skills is to use a prosecution's wits against them, right? And law enforcement agents are trained to testify. They go to a police academy, and they're literally trained to testify, how to look at the jury, how to present themselves, how to dress, how to make eye contact, how to answer questions, and they've also been prepped by the prosecutor. So law enforcement agents testify well. They do. And they do get the credibility of the jury as a result of that. So, you know, impeaching any witness, whether they're a law enforcement agent or not, is just drawing doubt as to the credibility, right? And you can do that based off something that they said that's inconsistent with something that's in the report or something that they said later. Or you can do, there's a variety of ways you can impeach a witness. But, you know, oftentimes because law enforcement agents testify so well because they've been trained to, that's an added benefit that they have the credibility of the jury.
Absolutely. And I really, really appreciate you coming on today and going through and having this lengthy conversation with us. And hopefully we can have you on again and kind of get deeper in and possibly have a better question and answer session. And is there anything that you would like to close with, and how can people get in contact with you?
Yeah, get in contact with me. You can visit our website, www.esqaspire.com. That's esqaspire.com. And my phone number is 818-298-9671. And it was a pleasure being on. I really look forward to coming back and discussing this further. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have a great evening. And thank you, guys. I hope you enjoy it. Be sure to look out for it. And there will be a poll at the end of this podcast. Talk to you guys soon.